Long lines at the U.S. Supreme Court today to honor Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The first of 2 days of her lying in repose. On Friday, she will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. More on that in a moment. This is Washington Today for September the 23rd. I'm Pedro Echevarria. On Capitol Hill, senators questioning NIH's Dr. Anthony Fauci not only on if government restrictions have been helpful in fighting the pandemic, but also when a vaccine will be developed, and when that happens, who will get it? And on the campaign trail, President Trump claiming that this year's election also includes a fight against communism. Joe Biden looks at reimagining the Justice Department. And Cindy McCain, the widow of former Arizona Republican Senator John McCain, offering her support for Joe Biden. But we start today at the Supreme Court, where Chief Justice John Roberts offered a eulogy for Justice Ginsburg, who will spend Wednesday and Thursday lying in repose at the court.
She was not an opera star, but she found her stage right behind me in our courtroom. There, she won famous victories that helped move our nation closer to equal justice under law, to the extent that women are now a majority in law schools, not simply a handful. Later, she became a star on the bench, where she sat for 27 years. Her 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions will steer the court for decades. They are written with the unaffected grace of precision. Her voice in court and in our conference room was soft, but when she spoke, people listened. Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest. When it came to opera, insightful, passionate. When it came to sports, clueless. Justice Ginsburg had many virtues of her own, but she also unavoidably promoted one particular one, humility, in others. For example, on more than a few occasions, someone would approach or call me and describe some upcoming occasion or event that was important to them, and I knew what was coming. Could I come and speak? But no, instead, could I pass along an invitation to Justice Ginsburg and put in a good word? Many of you have seen the famous picture of Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg riding atop an elephant in India. It captured so much of Ruth. There she was, doing something totally unexpected, just as she had in law school, where she was not only one of the few women, but a new mother to boot. And in the photograph, she is riding with a dear friend, a friend with totally divergent views. There is no indication in the photo that either was poised to push the other off. For many years, of course, Ruth battled serious illness. She met each of those challenges with a combination of candid assessment and fierce determination. In doing so, she encouraged others who have their own battles with illness, including employees here in the court. And she emerged victorious, time and again, against all odds. But finally, the odds won out, and now Ruth has left us.
That was Chief Justice John Roberts from earlier today. A steady line of mourners have passed by since this morning, including Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. We'll have more on that in a moment with Christina Marcos of The Hill. Back in the Senate, debate continued over filling the late justice's seat. According to an article in Politico, a number of Democratic senators and aides are concerned over how California Democrat Dianne Feinstein will handle the fight over Justice Ginsburg's seat. The article says, quote, "The Judiciary Committee is the critical battleground in the Supreme Court confirmation process. At stake, her own Democratic colleagues' worry is more than just whether the party can thwart Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in his rush to fill the seat. Some Democrats privately fear that Feinstein could mishandle the situation and hurt their chances of winning back the majority." It continues, quote, "Feinstein sometimes gets confused by reporters' questions, who are all for different answers to the same question depending on where and when she's asked. Her appearance is frail, and Feinstein's genteel demeanor, which seems like it belongs to a bygone Senate era, can lead to trouble with an increasingly hardline Democratic base, uninterested in collegiality or bipartisan platitudes." If you want to read more of that story, you can find it at Politico.com. From the floor earlier today, Here's Senator Feinstein.
She died last Friday, just 46 days before the 2020 presidential election. Importantly, under a Republican standard adopted in 2016, the Senate should not consider a Supreme Court nomination until after the inauguration of the next president, whoever that may be. Until recently, Republicans have been intent on their own standard, which they used to block consideration of Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee, to fill Justice Scalia's seat on the court. Now, can we have one set of rules for Democratic presidents and another for Republican ones? I think not. And to allow otherwise undermines not only our faith in Congress, but also the faith of people that we're going to stick by what we do and be impartial in the judicial system. Now, just 41 days before the election, Senate Republicans must abide by their own standard. So what's at stake? There's a great deal of attention this week as to whom the president might select. The simple truth, however, is his. No matter who President Trump nominates, fundamental rights and protections must be considered because they become at risk if the nominee doesn't respond positively and effectively to these. For example, in November, the court will hear a renewed legal challenge brought by the Trump administration to the Affordable Care Act. Given President Trump's promise to appoint a justice who would strike down the Affordable Care Act, health care access and protections for the nearly 130 million non-elderly Americans with pre-existing conditions are really in certain peril. And we have every reason for serious consideration and opposition if this protection is not continued. It is unbelievable that during a pandemic that has already killed more than 200,000 Americans, this president and his allies are rushing the nomination that could leave up to 30 million Americans without health care. I hope that doesn't happen.
That was Senator Feinstein from earlier today on the Senate floor. As you can imagine, Republicans also getting the chance to talk about their plans for filling the Supreme Court seat. Among them, South Dakota Senator John Thune.
I don't think anyone is surprised that Democrats have not reacted well to the idea that President Trump will nominate a third Supreme Court justice. After all, overreacting to Republican nominees is pretty much the Democrats' stock in trade. It doesn't matter who the nominee is, to hear the Democrats tell it, any Republican nominee is likely to bring about Armageddon. The fact that some Republican nominees in past years, and as recently as this past June, have sided with the liberal wing of the court more often than I would like, has not in any way restrained Democrats' hysteria each time a new Republican nominee is introduced. I thought we'd reached a low point 2 years ago with the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh, who suffered months of character assassination at the hands of Democrats. But it turns out that was not the low point, because we've reached a new low. As I said, Madam President, it's no surprise that Democrats have reacted with hysteria at the prospect of President Trump nominating another Supreme Court justice. It was disappointing, but hardly surprising, that yesterday the Democrat leader blocked a key Intelligence Committee hearing on election security, a topic he has repeatedly insisted is of overwhelming importance, to protest the thought of the Senate fulfilling its advice and consent role in confirming a principled conservative woman. Even Speaker Pelosi's overwrought statement that Republicans are, and I quote, coming after your children, end quote, seemed pretty much par for the course. But Democrats have not limited themselves to temper tantrums. No, Democrats have moved on to threats. Dare to confirm the president's duly nominated nominee, Democrats are now saying, and if we win back the majority in November, we will eliminate the legislative filibuster and pack the Supreme Court. In other words, if Republicans dare to fulfill the Senate's role of advising and consenting to the president's nominee, Democrats will upend our democratic institutions.
That was South Dakota Republican John Thune memorializing Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And here with more on the justice's first day of lying in repose at the Supreme Court is The Hill's Christina Marcos. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Christina Marcos, on your Twitter feed, a picture of a long line of people today wanting to pay respects. What kind of activity did we see at the court today?
So there was a long line even in the middle of the day on a Wednesday for all these members of the public who want to pay their respects to the late Justice Ginsburg. The line started all the way at the back of the Supreme Court, zigzagged a bunch of times, then snaked all the way to the front, where they're allowing people to walk from a distance in front of the casket in accordance with coronavirus pandemic guidelines outdoors and with masks and everything else. And it's clear that lots of people are eager to pay respects to a progressive icon. There were also lots of street vendors set up on the sidewalk near the start of the line who were selling Ruth Bader Ginsburg themed buttons and T-shirts and even masks. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for paying respects to the justice and among progressives for putting up a big fight in the Senate where they're trying to confirm her replacement as soon as possible.
How long will people be able to see her today and tomorrow at the court?
Her casket will be lying in repose throughout until late tonight, as well as all day tomorrow. So there's lots of time for people to come and pay their respects, and we're expecting potentially thousands of people to come and pay their respects with these long lines going all day long.
We heard earlier from the Chief Justice paying his respects. Did other members of the court get a chance to do that today?
Well, before Ginsburg's casket was moved out front, there was a ceremony inside the Supreme Court where Ginsburg's family and close friends and other members of the court paid their respects. And then her casket was moved outside for the members of the public to walk past.
As far as those paying of respects, did any notable show up today?
Former President Bill Clinton, who of course was the one who nominated Ginsburg to the bench in 1993, he stopped by this afternoon to pay his respects along with the former First Lady Hillary Clinton. There are also numerous members of Congress who walked across the street to pay their respects during this House vote series this afternoon. There were lots of House members who cast their votes and then walked right across the street. Senator Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Bernie Sanders, incidentally, both went to the same high school in Brooklyn as Justice Ginsburg. And so they also made a point of going over there as well.
Your story, which can be found at thehill.com, also highlights the fact that some of her former law clerks played today, the role they played.
That's right. As Ginsburg's casket arrived at the Supreme Court this morning, her former clerks lined up in front of the court and served as pallbearers to carry her casket inside the court up the stairs for the memorial service inside.
After tomorrow, she'll go to the Senate. What are the plans to honor her there?
So on Friday, Ginsburg will be the very first woman in American history to lie in state in the Capitol. She'll be in the Capitol's National Statuary Hall, where there'll be a private invitation-only ceremony due to the coronavirus pandemic. They don't want too many people in there. They want to maintain social distancing. And Ginsburg will, as I said, be the first woman to lie in state. Rosa Parks was the first woman to lie in honor, but since she was a private citizen, she wasn't granted the official honor of lying in state, which is only granted for public officials. And Ginsburg will also be the second Supreme Court justice to lie in state. The last justice who lay in state was William Howard Taft back in 1930, and he was both the Chief Justice and he also served as president.
Turning to the process of appointing another judge, what's the latest in the White House's and the Senate's intent to appoint that?
President Trump has said he plans to nominate, to announce his nominee, which he plans to be, has said will be a woman on Saturday. And so once the memorial services for Ginsburg are finished, President Trump and Senate Republicans are planning to move very quickly to get this nomination through the hearing process onto the Senate floor. And then from what they want to plan is to get this confirmation completed as soon as a week or two before the election.
Have we seen any specific plan of action emerge from congressional Democrats on how they'll handle this process?
Well, Democrats recognize that their leverage is quite limited. And so there's been some chatter among some on the left about starting an impeachment inquiry because, as you'll recall, in the very beginning of this year, when the Senate held an impeachment trial by the Senate's by the impeachment trial rules, that has to take precedence over all other business. So in their argument, if they forced an impeachment inquiry and the Senate had to have a trial, they wouldn't be able to have time to confirm a new justice. But as you'll recall, vulnerable House Democrats were not exactly excited to start the impeachment process last year. They only did so when the evidence to them became very compelling to do so. And so there's not a whole lot of agitation, broadly speaking, among the House Democratic caucus to do that. But for now, Senate Democrats are trying things like trying to stall business. There are a lot of things in the Senate that require unanimous consent. Perhaps they'll stop doing that for routine requests. So there are some things Democrats can do to slow things down. But in terms of can they stop the actual vote, it's quite limited.
TheHill.com is where you can find our guest work. Christina Marcos reports for that publication. And we thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, White House coronavirus advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci pushed back against Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul's claim that New York has overcome the coronavirus pandemic because it achieved herd immunity, telling the Republican lawmaker he's, quote, not listening. During a hearing of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee focusing on the nation's coronavirus response, Senator Paul claimed that New York's death rate is among the highest in the world, despite shuttering businesses and schools earlier this year to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Here is some of that exchange.
Dr. Fauci, today you said you are not for economic lockdown, yet your mitigation recommendations from dating to baseball to restaurants to movie theaters have led to this economic lockdown. Do you have any second thoughts about your mitigation recommendations, considering the evidence that despite all of the things we've done in the U.S., our death rate is essentially worse than Sweden, equivalent to the less developed world that is unable to do any of the things that you've been promoting? Do you have any second thoughts? Are you willing to look at the data that countries that did very little actually have a lower death rate than the United States?
You know, Senator, I'd be happy at a different time to sit down and go over detail. You've said a lot of different things. You've compared us to Sweden, and there are a lot of differences. And you said, well, you know, there are a lot of differences between Sweden, but compare Sweden's death rate to other comparable Scandinavian countries. It's worse. So I don't think it's appropriate to compare Sweden with us. Yes, we have, I think in the beginning, we've done things based on the knowledge we had at the time. And hopefully, and I am, and my colleagues are, humble enough and modest enough to realize that as new data comes, you make different recommendations. But I don't regret saying that the only way we could have really stopped the explosion of infection was by essentially, when I say shutting down, I mean essentially having the physical separation and the kinds of recommendations that we've made.
You've been a big fan of Cuomo and the shutdown in New York. Okay. You've lauded New York for their policy. New York had the highest death rate in the world. How could we possibly be jumping up and down and saying, oh, Governor Cuomo did a great job? He had the worst death rate in the world.
No, you misconstrued that, Senator, and you've done that repetitively in the past. They got hit very badly. They've made some mistakes. Right now, if you look at what's going on right now, the things that are going on in New York to get their test positivity 1% or less is because they are looking at the guidelines that we have put together from the task force of the four or five things of masks, social distancing, outdoors more than indoors, avoiding crowds, and washing hands.
Or they've developed enough community immunity right. that they're no longer having the pandemic because they have enough immunity in New York City to actually stop.
I challenge that, Senator.
Please, sir,
I would like to be able to do this because this happens with Senator Rand all the time. You were not listening to what the director of the CDC said, that in New York it's about 22%. If you believe 22% is herd immunity, I believe you're alone in that.
Dr. Fauci from earlier today, vaccines also a topic at that hearing. Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, questioned Dr. Fauci for the latest information about a possible vaccine for the virus and when it might be ready for mass distribution.
If the FDA were to approve an application, let's say on November 1st, how long would it take for the American people to get vaccinated? Maybe I'll change that to say, what proportion of our population, if it were approved on November 1st, what proportion of our population would be able to be vaccinated, let's say, by the end of the year? That's a two-month period.
Yeah.
I don't know whether these manufacturing facilities are producing 100 million vaccines right now or 5 million or 10 million. So is this something that would really just go to a small subset of the population? Yeah. Or could we possibly inoculate the great majority?
No. Well, good question, Senator. The fact is that the production as it is rolling out, and when you hear the numbers, that's the totality of all of the companies. So that in November, you'll probably be, you know, maybe 50 million doses available. By December, maybe another 100 plus million. And then when you get into January, February, by the time you get to April, there'll be a total of about 700 million. So if you're talking about who's going to get vaccinated in December or November, it is not going to be a large proportion of the population. It will be according to what we were discussing before, namely those who are, according to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, getting the priority. Likely will be healthcare providers and likely will be those who are vulnerable with underlying conditions. I can't say that for certain, but if anything is the past, this prologue, that likely will be the case. But we're not going to have all of the doses available, for example, by the end of December. They will be rolling in as the months go by, and by the time you get to maybe the third or fourth month of the 2021, then you'll have doses for everyone.
Much more took place at that Senate Help Committee hearing. If you want to see the whole thing, you can go to our website at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. This is Washington Today. I'm your host, Pedro Echevarria. In some other headlines, two Republican-led Senate committees issued a report on Wednesday alleging the work Joe Biden's son did in Ukraine constituted a conflict of interest for the Obama administration at a time when Biden was engaged in Ukraine policy as vice president. But despite saying Hunter Biden having a position on the board of a Ukrainian energy company was, quote, awkward and problematic and interfered with, quote, efficient execution of policy, the report said it was ultimately, quote, unclear what impact that may have had on the Obama administration policy with regard to Ukraine. And it offered no evidence to support one of President Trump's more incendiary allegations that Joe Biden pressured Ukraine to fire its top prosecutor as a way to protect his son. You can read more of that story at TheGuardian.com. The president announced today a new series of economic sanctions on Cuba that bans U.S. citizens from buying Cuban cigars as well as rum and staying at Cuban government-owned hotels on the communist-run island. The announcement seemed to be a clear attempt to appeal to Cuban-American voters in Florida, which is seen by many analysts as a must-win state for the president if he's to be reelected in November. You can watch that full announcement at cspan.org. Finally, the Metropolitan Opera announced they have canceled the entire 2020-21 season due to the ongoing health crisis, according to a news release that was issued Wednesday. The 2021-22 season will open with the premiere of Terrence Blanchard's Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Blanchard's opera is the first by an African-American composer to be performed at the Met. According to the release, the Met's decision to cancel the season was based on advice of health officials.
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
That was the reaction earlier this afternoon in Louisville, Kentucky. A former Louisville police officer has been indicted by a grand jury on first-degree wanton endangerment charges connected to the police raid on the night Breonna Taylor was killed by police, but no charges related to her shooting death. Two other officers at the shooting were not indicted. The long-awaited charges against former officer Brent Hankison were immediately criticized by demonstrators and activists who had demanded more serious counts and the arrest of three officers involved in the March shooting. The charges pertain to Hankison's allegedly firing blindly through a door and window in Taylor's building. Two other officers, Sergeant John Mattingly and Detective Miles Cosgrove, were not charged. Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron told reporters Wednesday that the officers were, quote, justified in their use of force because Taylor's boyfriend fired at the officers first. The American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky, in a tweet, called the decision not to charge the officers in her death, quote, the latest miscarriage of justice in our nation's long history of denying that Black lives matters, and goes on to say, once again, a prosecutor has refused to hold law enforcement accountable for killing a young Black woman. Breonna Taylor should still be alive today. The NAACP, in a statement, said that the justice system failed Taylor and the charges against one officer do not go far enough. You can find more of that story at CNN.com. Back on Capitol Hill, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a confirmation hearing for Acting Director Chad Wolf. He faced questions on two recent whistleblower reports from department employees. The legitimacy of the appointment to his current role also has been challenged in federal court and the Government Accountability Office. Wolf has served as acting secretary to the department since November. He was sworn in on an interim basis shortly after being confirmed by the Senate for a different role as undersecretary of the department's Office of Strategy, Policy, and Plans. That took place in a 54-41 vote. Here's the committee's ranking member, Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan, questioning Wolf from earlier today.
Can you confirm that the department assesses white supremacist violence to be the most deadly threat now facing our nation today?
I think when you talk about domestic terrorism, so I want to be clear on that front. When you talk about domestic terrorism, we talk about homegrown violent extremists, which are folks that are inspired, motivated, or directed by foreign terrorist organizations. And then we talk about domestic violent extremists. Within that category are racially and ethnically motivated individuals, and certainly white supremacist extremists from a lethality standpoint over the last 2 years, particularly when you look at 2018 and 2019, are certainly the most persistent and lethal threat when we talk about domestic violent extremists. But I think your question was all of the threats facing the homeland. I don't think I would agree that you know, out of all the threats facing the homeland, from nation-state threats to pandemics to hurricanes and the like, that is the most, you know.
Yes, important. And that was my intent. That was that you answered. It's dealing with those terrorist attacks. That was the intent of the question.
But I do want to say that it's important as we talk about domestic violent extremists and we talk about historically 2018, 2019, we cannot ignore what has been occurring over the past 4 months when we talk about anti-government extremists, anarchist extremists, anti-law enforcement folks. It's very important that we continue to look at and address the threat that's been occurring in the country over the last 4 months.
Well, I agree. And I want a quick question here that I know the department finally released your public action to implement strategic framework for countering terrorism and targeted violence. A long time coming. It's out now. Specifically, what actual steps has the department taken? In addition to this report, what actual steps has the department taken to reduce the threat communities face from white supremacist actors? And I know there are some grant programs out there. Please don't talk about the grant programs. What specific actions has the department taken, given the fact, as you just mentioned, given the threat posed by white supremacist groups?
Well, understanding you don't want to talk about the grant programs, but that is a big part of what we do, at least in the prevention space.
Yeah, and I'm granting that. I'm giving you that. I want to know what else.
We also do community awareness briefings, and we do other types of briefings that our office of TVTP does as well in conjunction with CRCL and others. So part of our mission is to make sure that we are educating folks for sharing information. So we're also pushing out probably, I believe, since April, INA has pushed out roughly 20 or so products regarding white supremacist extremism to our state and local law enforcement officers. So those are to our fusion centers. So we're pushing intelligence out. but then we're also providing those community awareness briefings and the like. And a big part of that are the resources that we put behind that, which are the grant programs themselves.
Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf on Capitol Hill today. More of that available at cspan.org. By the way, Wolf is the fifth person to head DHS, which has seen high turnover and an unprecedented number of vacant positions among its leadership. At the White House, President Trump hosted an event honoring veterans of the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion into Cuba and announced new sanctions against the country. According to the announcement, the State Department is creating a list of properties that travelers will be barred from staying at, including those controlled or owned by the Cuban government, certain government officials, and members of the Cuban Communist Party, as well as their close relatives. The actions come against the backdrop of a presidential election where the president is heavily courting Hispanic voters, particularly those with ties to Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, with a strident anti-socialist message. The campaign has made the subject a major focus in key states with sizable Latino populations such as Arizona, Nevada, and especially Florida. From earlier today, here's President Trump.
Today we proclaim that America will never be a socialist or communist country. And I'm going to add that word, or communist. It's the first time I've ever said that. I've never added the other word, but I think it's appropriate, Mike, when you look at the kind of ideology we're also facing, when you see the rioters, looters, anarchists, and then you see the press, the media, play right into their hands. It's so sad to see the media, the way they're being used. The media is being used like fools. They're being used, and it's very sad to watch, but we will prevail. It's the first time I've said that, though. Socialism and communism. We did not fight tyranny abroad only to let Marxists destroy our beloved country. Together, we will defend our freedom in our American way of life, and we will defend it strongly and successfully, as we've been doing. And as we celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month, we give thanks to the countless ways that Hispanic Americans uplift and inspire our nation. They've been so good to me, and I must tell you that the big story is the poll numbers. Trump has gone through the roof with the poll numbers from Hispanics. They're all talking about it. Watched something and read a couple of articles, and they don't know what's happening. I guess they didn't know I love you, but I do. They're incredible people, incredible people. They knew it, but they're all shocked. It hasn't been a time when something like this has happened.
The president from earlier today. In other campaign 2020 news, last night, Cindy McCain, widow of the late Senator John McCain, endorsed Joe Biden for president. She indicated that Biden's values outweigh the political differences between them. She tweeted, quote, "My husband John lived by a code. Country first. We are Republicans, yes, but Americans foremost. There's only one candidate in the race who stands up for our values as a nation, and that is Joe Biden," close quote. This morning, she was on ABC's Good Morning America and added to her endorsement and reacted to President Trump's Twitter response.
"You've been a loyal Republican for an awful long time. Even though you're good friends with Joe Biden and his family, you must disagree with him on lots of issues."
"Sure, we disagree, but you know something, it's okay to disagree. And you can do it and be amenable about it and be kind to each other. And so that's that. Therein lies the kind of leadership that my husband and Joe showed when they were both, you know, on the Senate floor together. Disagreeing on not every issue, but some issues, and then remaining friends. I mean, that's what this is all about."
"I know you've also been concerned by the comments attributed to President Trump in that Atlantic article about the military last week. Of course, he made very public comments about your husband time and time again. What role did that play in all of this?"
"Well, both Joe and I are Blue Star parents. We have watched our sons step on board either a bus or an airplane, whatever it was, headed to combat. And that changes you. So Joe understands what it means to be a military family. And that's something that is so necessary right now. And respect for the troops. You can say a lot of things, but men and women who gave the ultimate sacrifice are not losers. And people that served are not losers."
As you might imagine, this has drawn a response from President Trump just minutes ago. It's just coming in right now. He sent out a tweet. He said, never a fan of John. Cindy can have Sleepy Joe. Your response?
I don't have any.
And that was Cindy McCain earlier today. Now, with just 41 days left until Election Day, Joe Biden spent the afternoon in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was there that he took a number of questions from the audience.
First, I want to thank you. You honored me and my family by sending a video tribute for my sister, Cynthia Graham Hurd.
Oh, my Lord, I apologize.
No.
I didn't know. I'm sorry.
Who was, as you know, killed at the Emmanuel AME church shooting in Charleston. And so my question is, how do you reimagine the Justice Department and specifically the Civil Rights Division after 4 years of Trump?
Well, first of all, and I guess I'll just say it, this has been the most corrupt administration in modern American history. The Justice Department has turned into the president's private law firm. He actually has him representing him on women who accuse him of rape and, I mean, where does that come from? And the Justice Department under my administration will be totally independent of me. I will not direct them who to prosecute, how to prosecute, what to prosecute, and I will not be enter their decisions based upon the judgments they make about what cases they bring and they don't bring. With regard to the Civil Rights Division, I would significantly increase two things. One, civil rights presence in the Justice Department elevated so it has access to and transparency into all police departments' activities across the country, just so they are aware, there's transparent what's going on. I would also make sure that I elevate the Justice Department, the Civil Rights Division, to have a direct office with inside the White House.
Democratic nominee Joe Biden from earlier today. This is Washington Today. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex have weighed in on the upcoming U.S. presidential vote, urging people to reject online negativity and hate speech as what Meghan Markle described as, quote, the most important election of our lifetime approaches. The couple, who now live in California, shared remarks in a brief video message congratulating those who were named in this year's Time 100 list of most influential people, which aired on a virtual broadcast on ABC on Tuesday evening. Harry and Meghan called on viewers around the world to act with compassion in both physical and digital worlds, use their voices, be engaged with their communities in the civic process, and care for one another according to their representatives.
But when the bad outweighs the good, for many, whether we realize it or not, it erodes our ability to have compassion and our ability to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. Because when one person buys into negativity online, the effects are felt exponentially. It's time to not only reflect, but act.
Now, we're just 6 weeks out from Election Day, and today is National Voter Registration Day. Every 4 years, we are told the same thing, that this is the most important election of our lifetime. But this one is. When we vote, our values are put into action and our voices are heard. Your voice is a reminder that you matter, because you do, and you deserve to be heard.
This election, I'm not going to be able to vote here in the US. But many of you may not know that I haven't been able to vote in the UK my entire life. As we approach this November, it's vital that we reject hate speech, misinformation, and online negativity.
So as we work to reimagine the world around us, let's challenge ourselves to build communities of compassion.
Tonight reminds us of how important it is to watch out for each other, to care for each other, and to inspire each other. We are incredibly proud to join you in this historic moment in time.
Thank you.
That was Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan Markle. And here to talk about other notables on the list is Time Senior Editor Emma Barker. Emma Barker, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off by describing to the audience how Time determines who's influential?
Of course. So part of the process of getting the list together is we talk with our correspondents and our editors all around the world, as well as former Time 100 alums who have been on the list themselves and can speak to people who are kind of carrying their legacies forward. And that's how we get our ideas for the list. Then it's a process of looking at those people and determining not only who had the most influence in this year, but also who really feels like they represent the big stories of the year and move the conversation forward in a particular way.
I imagine that you have a list of 100, but it doesn't start with that many people. Where does the starting go, and how does that get whittled down?
Yeah, we received more than 1,000 nominations this year, and it went from 1,000 to 100. So the whittling down, I mean, there's a lot of levels of it, but it takes place over the course of several months. So there's a lot of kind of back and forth, and it goes down until the day before we publish, because news is constantly happening, and we want to make sure that the list feels most representative of the full time that the full past year.
Many on that list are familiar to C-SPAN's audience, President Trump among them, in which the magazine writes that, quote, Trump's calculations have had real-world consequences. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I don't think anyone can deny how much Donald Trump has changed the conversation this year and in past years. But this year in particular, you know, both for good and for ill, I think a lot of major stories can be traced back to him. There are some ways that his kind of power plays have paid off in the deals between Israel and Gulf Arab states. But there is also, you know, our 200,000 deaths to COVID in the U.S., which many in the medical community have attributed to a slow response.
You speak of the medical community on the top. If you go to the website on the top of the leaders page, you'll see a man who had been seen by the president's side a lot this year, Dr. Anthony Fauci. What makes him part of the list?
Yeah, I think Fauci was one of our first picks and one of the more obvious ones. He really came forward in probably one of the most challenging years many of us can think of in the past several decades as a real leader and someone that people looked to for facts and real advice. And he came through in moments when we were sometimes lacking other forms of leadership.
On the section with Dr. Fauci, it's written by the talk show host Jimmy Kimmel. Can you explain why that is?
Yeah, Kimmel has come forward throughout the year and throughout his career as a real proponent of healthcare and you know, pushing for healthcare for everyone and making sure that everyone is really aware of that as a topic, both political and not political. So we felt like he was a good person to weigh in on Fauci.
Then another person that you will find on the list, again, familiar to C-SPAN's audience, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in the section that was written by the Democratic chair, Hakeem Jeffries. There's a sentence: in these turbulent waters, Speaker Pelosi has masterfully captained the ship. Can you go on from there?
Yeah. Speaker Pelosi really stood out to us as someone who should be on this list in large part due to her driving impeachment, which is an incredibly historic thing. And, you know, to a lot of people, I think that feels like an ages ago at this point in the news cycle, but it really was, you know, just in December. So we felt like that was vital to include, and she handled that in a really both aggressive but also solemn manner that I think was admirable.
Emma Barker, when you close the book on this list, what do you want people to walk away with in viewing not only the ones we've talked about, but others?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about this year was just how much the nature of influence itself shifted this year. So many more activists and grassroots organizers on this year's list, as well as the doctors and nurses who were on the ground working on the front lines of the COVID crisis. But just, you know, oftentimes these lists are centered around these kind of world leaders and some of the people that we've already spoken about today. But so many of the most exciting people on the list and some of the people that are getting the most attention today are these activists who do not have traditional forms of power, but really rose in this year when when we were facing a lot of crises.
We're talking with Time senior editor Emma Barker. If someone wants to find the list online, where can they find it?
They can go to time.com, and it'll be right there on the homepage.
Emma Barker with Time. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. If you missed any of Washington Today, you can always find it as a podcast at c-span.org/podcast, or you can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and you'll never miss an episode. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.